Welcome to the reading of the Quad City Times for today, Monday, the 6th of May, 2024. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of people with print disabilities. Your readers today are Carol Lockhart and Jeff Cassett, and here's Carol with our first story.
Thank you, Jeff. Two dead after shooting in Moline. Police are investigating a shooting that left a 17-year-old and a 20-year-old dead in Moline early Sunday morning. At approximately 4:35 a.m. on Sunday, the Moline Police Department responded to a 911 call about an unknown problem at a residence in the 1800 block of 31st Street in Moline, according to a press release. In the building's basement, police said they found two males, aged 17 and 20, both of Moline, dead, with apparent gunshot wounds. Earlier that morning, around 2:30 a.m., police say they responded to a noise complaint at the residence after a caller reported, quote, a large house party and unruly behavior. Police said many individuals left the scene prior to their arrival. The call is believed to be related to the homicides later that morning, police said. The incident is now under investigation by Moline police, who are asking anyone with information related to the event to call Crime Stoppers of the Quad Cities at 309-762-9500. Anyone with photo or video evidence related to the event can submit to the Moline Police Department online portal, accessible via the attached QR code. I guess you don't have that unless you have a paper. The tragic events that have unfolded in our community this past weekend are a sobering reminder that we have work to do in helping our young people to turn away from violence, Moline Mayor Sangeetha Rayapati said. And now we'll go to Jeff Cassett.
Woman gives CPR after shooting. Police chief confirms one dead in East Moline. Rachel Downing had just reached her car when she heard gunshots ring out through East Moline's Deerfield Woods apartments. The 23-year-old Downing ducked for safety. Then she heard a body fall to the pavement and someone screaming. East Moline Police Chief Jeffrey Ramsey said that one person is dead after the shooting, which took place around 11:45 p.m. on Saturday. There's an active investigation going on regarding a shooting at the Deerfield Woods apartment complex, Ramsey said via email. He added there is no further danger to the public. Ramsey did not provide information about the victim's identity. Downing said she was leaving a friend's apartment when the gunfire erupted. She didn't hesitate when the man fell and she rushed to his side. I rolled the man over and started CPR, she said. He was gushing blood out of his back really bad. Downing, who works as medication partner in a dementia unit, had just recertified in CPR last month. I did not attempt mouth-to-mouth, she explained. By the time I got to him, I could tell his lungs were filling with blood and he was coughing it out. I have no clue who the guy was or what exactly looked like since it was so dark, Downing said. The victim was alive when the first responders took him from the scene. She said her thoughts were with the man and his family. I'm still pretty worked up, Downing said Sunday afternoon. I still come into work just to keep my head straight. I would do it again 1,000 times over, especially if it meant saving a life. Carol?
Thank you, Jeff. And also from the local page, Quad City Craft Beer Week set to return. The event is to celebrate 5 years of the Quad City Ale Trail. We all know April showers bring May flowers. But what about April food bringing May brews? Visit Quad Cities, which hosted Quad City Restaurant Week in early April. It's partnering with local home brewing club Mugs to host the annual Quad City Craft Beer Week, the Quad Cities wide event, which will run from May 10th to May 17th, has been around since 2011 and seeks to bring craft beer enthusiasts together. Quad City Craft Beer Week never disappoints and is a great reminder of how fortunate we are in the Quad Cities region to have such a thriving craft beer community, said Dave Harrell, president and CEO of Visit Quad Cities, in a release shared earlier this week. This year's Quad City Craft Beer Week will coincide with the five-year anniversary of the Quad City Ale Trail, an interactive self-guided brewery tour spanning both sides of the Mississippi River, the release said. Through the Quad City Ale Trail, craft beer fans can redeem prizes and meet up with fellow drinkers. We are thrilled to commemorate five incredible years of the Quad City Ale Trail, Harrell said. Our Quad City Ale Trail continues to promote and bind together the Quad City craft beer scene, which adds value to tourism products, visitor experience, and resident pride. Since in its inception, Quad City Ale Trail has expanded from 12 locations to 16 locations. Participating in Quad City Craft Beer Week will include Five Cities Brewing, Bent River Brewery, Crawford Brew Works, Midwest Ale Works, Radical Effect Brew Works, Rebels and Lions Brewing, Stamp Box Brewing, Twin Span Brewing, and Wake Brewing, with more potentially added in the next week. Throughout the Quad City Craft Beer Week, there will be a variety of brewing events. On Friday, May 10th, Front Street Tap Room in Davenport will hold a Quad City Ale Trail five-year anniversary pop-up party. The party will run from 4 to 7 p.m. on Saturday, May 11th. Brew fans can take to the river with the Bell Cruises Quad Cities Beer Battle from 12:30 to 3 p.m. The next weekend, Mugs Homebrew will hold collaboration tapping events at Endless Brews in Davenport and Sally's in Rock Island on May 17th and May 18th, respectively. Also on May 18th, Downtown LeClaire will have a Shops with Hops event from 2 to 5 p.m. The Mugs collaboration tapping events will bring at-home and professional brewers together to come up with new brews. Mugs president Brian Schmidt said in the release, "It's exciting to see the variety that everyone comes up with and have all those ideas on tap at once." Jeff?
JC's Names Award winners. JC's of the Quad Cities honored several community members this year who are making a positive impact. The JC's of the Quad Cities Community Awards celebration showcases excellence in leadership from individuals under the age of 40 who have demonstrated outstanding initiative, impact of work, and inspiration of others. The Young Community Leader Award was received by Mary Beth Angerer, owner of Angerer Eats. Angerer supports families affected by cancer by providing meals to Gilda's Club. In September of 2023, she provided group dinners before support sessions. Mary has since crowdfunded nearly $3,645 to buy a large freezer for Gilda's Club, pledging to fill it weekly with meals for families impacted by cancer. Paige Shepherd, language arts teacher at Bettendorf High School, has been awarded the Young Educator Award. Shepherd developed a multicultural literature course from proposal to execution. She designed this curriculum and attracted 50 students to enroll in the course. The Young Religious Leader Award went to Zach Sandry, youth pastor at Heritage Church. Beyond his ministry duties, Sandry volunteers as a baseball coach. He and his family extend their care and assistance to those in need, embodying a spirit of generosity and compassion. Sandry actively encourages others to volunteer and participates in community events. Corporal Emily Rash received the Young City Servant Award in recognition of her exhibited city leadership. Corporal Rash has had a distinguished career within the police force, starting as a detective in the narcotics unit before being promoted to the patrol division. She spent 5 years undercover and was instrumental in numerous large-scale narcotics and weapons arrests. Corporal Rash also trained newer detectives and decided to pursue a promotion to patrol, where she now serves as a field training officer, mentoring new officers. Davenport JC's Foundation Scholarship recipient is Claire Doran, a senior at Moline High School. Doran will receive the $2,000 Community Service Scholarship, selected by her peers to represent her school at Rotary meetings. She's also dedicated herself to community service, logging the most volunteer hours in a month for the Interact Club. In addition to the community leaders honored, the JCs honored four of their own members. This past year's honorees include 2023 JCs Member of the Year, Drew Grace. This award recognizes an individual member that has been actively involved with the chapter, shows great leadership, and is a role model to other members. 2023 JC's Rookie of the Year, Shannon Lane and Ashley Gore. This award recognizes a first-year member of the chapter that has shown great initiative and involvement in various JC's programs and events. And 2023 JC's Project of the Year, Lisa Gerhardt, Taco Bout a Nonprofit Fair. Taco Bout a Nonprofit Fair. This new award recognizes members of the chapter that have shown leadership and creativity by creating a new successful event. Congratulations to all those people. Carol?
Thank you, Jeff. And Family Resources in Davenport to lay off 26. Dozens of people will lose their jobs at the end of June at Family Resources in Davenport, according to a notice posted on the Iowa WARN list, W-A-R-N list. 26 people will be laid off June 30th. The listed notice date to employees is April 25th. The notice lists mass layoff as the reason, but does not provide any other information. The organization also has locations in Moline, Muscatine, and Clinton. An email to Family Resources Incorporated was not immediately returned Friday afternoon. In November, the nonprofit moved from its long-standing location at the Annie Wittenmeyer campus to 1414 West Lombard Street. Family Resources offers a wide array of services for families and survivors of violent crime, among other resources, and moved in response to the evolving needs of the people served by the organization, according to a news release at the time. The new location was expected to offer increased parking and accessibility, according to Family Resources, and is located along a City of Davenport bus line. And another article here, another short one. Man facing forgery and theft charges. A Davenport man taken into custody Thursday faces three felony charges for allegedly using checks and deposit envelopes to steal tens of thousands of dollars from area banks. Charles Gripp, 38, faces the felony charges of first-degree theft, ongoing criminal activity, and forgery. According to Eldridge Police, Grip wrote bad checks totaling $24,273. In a search warrant request, the Eldridge police officer said the investigation into Grip's alleged scam started on March 4th, after a branch manager of First Trust and Savings Bank in Eldridge reported check fraud from branches in Eldridge, Dixon, and Donahue. During the investigation, Eldridge police said they developed information linking Grip to scams on banks in LeClaire, Davenport, that may have started as early as November 10, 2023. One of the ways investigators allege Grip stole from banks was by depositing checks from a closed account and then withdrawing the amount in cash of the checks immediately after the deposit. Investigators say he also deposited empty envelopes into a bank AMT, claiming there was cash in the envelopes. He then withdrew, in cash, the amount he had claimed to deposit. In the search warrant, Eldridge investigators said Grip had an accomplice. As of Friday, there is no record of that person being arrested or charged in Scott County. Davenport police detectives attempted to arrest Grip on April 1st, but he allegedly fled a traffic stop and eluded his pursuers. He was arrested Thursday and faces additional misdemeanor charges of eluding and interference with official acts. He's being held on a $30,000 cash-only bond and secured bonds of $5,000 and $3,000. Jeff?
Learning Center sees changes. Davenport facility to relaunch programming. Big changes are coming to the Davenport Learning Center. After years of using it for storage and other district-wide activities, Davenport Schools will reopen the facility for student programming next school year. It'll house three therapeutic classrooms, a state-funded program for students with individual education plan with significant social, emotional, or behavioral needs, and two alternative education classrooms for an alternative education pilot program. The pilot program will serve high school students who are removed from their home schools due to disciplinary action. Davenport's three traditional high schools currently use a redirection program to address these students. District leaders say the separate learning setting of the pilot program will better serve those students. We understand that they still need an authentic learning environment and probably some additional mental health supports to find success, said Courtney Olson, Director of Equity and Learning Supports. Similar programming left the Davenport Learning Center in 2020 when Keystone Academy closed. As previously reported, this came as part of a $4.69 million budget cut for fiscal 2020. In the past, Davenport Schools contracted with Specialized Education Services, Inc. to deliver therapeutic classroom services at individual buildings. This contract expires at the end of the 23-24 school year, but the district wanted to continue providing therapeutic classrooms in-house for students in 3rd through 10th grades. District leaders and IEP teams are working to develop entry-exit criteria for both programs, driven by research and best practices, said Special Education Program Director Aaron Room. Because we want to make sure we give students portable skills that they can learn, acquire, and then apply in different environments, he said. Each new Davenport Learning Center classroom will staff one teacher and two paraeducators, with additional specialized staff in the therapeutic classrooms. There will be a social worker assigned to that program, Olson said, a behavioral intervention strategist, and then other district-level supports from our special education department. On Monday, April 22nd, the Davenport School Board approved Rachel Ivory as the principal for Davenport Learning Center. She was the former principal of Buchanan Elementary School before it closed after the 22-23 school year. Superintendent Schneckloth said the facility's revamping aligns with the district's goal of expanding its continuum of student services and supports. Over the past year, there have been many student support pieces put in place, he said, giving kudos to district teachers, staff, and coordinator teams. This is a piece our students need, and we're ready for it now. Storage aside, the Davenport Learning Center building also houses afternoon and summer enrichment programs, stepping stones, and the district-wide bakery. Our operations warehouse and maintenance shops are all on that property as well, Schneckloth said. It's had many purposes over the years, and what makes it very valuable is that it's very centrally located. The building is located on West Kimberly Road, a main Davenport thoroughfare. That kind of makes it an easy campus to access for both parking and transportation, so students aren't on buses for very long, he said. A new pilot at Eisenhower Elementary and progress at Mid-City High. The Davenport Learning Center isn't the only district building seeing some change to help students who may need additional supports. Next school year, Eisenhower Elementary School will pilot the Infinity Program, geared toward students with IEPs who have significant needs or delays in the area of communication, social-emotional, and adaptive behavior. It's for students who just require unique supports and expertise beyond what might be sustainable in a general education classroom, Room said, so it's not meant for any specific disability. He said the need for the Infinity program is seen by a number of district students on the autism spectrum, along with related support agencies across the Quad Cities Metro. Really, the hope is to give students some good functional communication skills and just be a more inclusive learning environment right now, Room said. There's certainly a growing need for this kind of continuum of support in our area. The past school year, Davenport also piloted a Bridges program at Mid-City High School, the district's alternative transitional high school model. Bridges was designed to help incoming ninth graders who have historically struggled to engage with school, Schneckloth said, April 22nd via the district's autodialer email. Mid-City also lost the ability to accept ninth graders due to the district's fiscal 2021 budget cuts. Students in the program earn high school credit in a smaller classroom environment. They also work to develop healthy study and work habits. In the first quarter, we saw a lot of great student success, Olson said. A majority of them met the criteria to transition out of the program and go back to either their home school or stay at Mid-City. Now, district leaders are reflecting on lessons learned and planning Bridges for next year. As these programs develop, Schneckloth looks forward to expanding the district's student supports via continued research, analysis, and student needs. We have students going to Ivy League schools, in trades, and other paths, he said. So we want to make sure that our continuum is strong, and that's one of the things I'm really proud our team is doing. They're really looking at how best to serve all of our students in the right environments. Carol?
Thank you, Jeff. And cicadas are expected to emerge soon. Quad Cities' impact should be minimal, so you won't have it as bad as other people. A double brood of cicadas are about to break loose. But there's good news for the Quad Cities area. The impact is expected to be minimal. Every year, cicadas, sometimes called dog day cicadas because they emerge in the dog days of summer, arrive across the world, said Nahant Marsh Executive Director Brian Ritter. This year, two broods that have been underground for more than a decade will emerge much earlier. Called periodical cicadas, there are about 15 known broods. Scientists are still working out why they appear in certain areas. One brood has been spotted in only three counties in New York. Tierney Brosius, an associate professor of biology at Augustana College, said, It is a really unique biological phenomenon. One of the working theories has to do with the boom and bust cycle, she said, as a way to satiate the animal. If the periodical cicadas came out of the ground annually, there would be too many, and the broods would be overrun by each other as they compete for resources. Excuse me while I find my other continuing here. Instead, scientists think the cycles have to do with avoiding parasites, finding the right temperature, and survival. Still, it's rare two broods emerge at the same time, said Zach Shum, an insect diagnostician at Iowa State University. In fact, it only happens once every 221 years, and only in one place. The only place in the world that has periodical cicadas is North America, he said. Brood number 13, known as the Northern Illinois brood, the 17-year cicadas will be mostly in our neck of the woods, the summer, Ritter said. Brood 19 was underground for 13 years and will be most present in southern and central Illinois. Shum said the cicadas have spent the last several years underground feeding on plant roots and will emerge all at once. The good news for locals is both broods are not expected to be in the same area as last time. Based on geographical data from their last emergence in 2007, the cicadas will overlap in just a handful of counties in central Illinois and possibly some parts of southern Iowa. There is a small chance for overlap in southeast Iowa, potentially as far north as the southern part of Louisa County, Ritter said. Brood 19, also known as the Great Southern Brood, has already been reported in parts of southern Illinois, Missouri, and a handful of southern states, including Arkansas, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Georgia. Shum said no matter where you are in those locations, you should only see one brood. Distinguishing between each brood of cicada is tricky, Brocious said, because they all look fairly similar. Researchers at Purdue University identify periodical cicadas as a whole as having darker bodies with nearly black or brown wings and red eyes. Annual cicadas are more of a mossy green in color. Cicadas tend to stay in pockets, Ritter said, and will be most common near rivers, waterways, and woodland areas. For those living in the city, the chances are slim to none. The insects will be too much of a disturbance. He said they'll be in places that have been woods for 17 years or more. The last time they were out, they needed places to go. In 2007, it was pretty spotty due to development and pesticide use on the landscape in those areas that have mature woodlands. The emergence will occur once the soil hits 64 degrees. Once they emerge from the ground, they shed their skins and metamorphize into adults. For a few weeks, they'll lay eggs on trees and shrubs, and then they will die off, Ritter said. The eggs will develop into larvae, which will eventually fall onto the ground. Once the new cicadas hatch, they will burrow underground for the next 17 years, feeding on the sap of tree roots until it's time for the next emergence. Based on historical data, there is not a lengthy record of them being in the Quad Cities area at all, he said. For those who live near woodlands or hike often, it will be noisier than usual. The decibel level will be close to the same level as a vacuum, he said. While the cicadas may be loud and annoying, that's luckily about the extent of the damage that they will do. They do not sting, they are not venomous, and they do not harm people or animals. They do, however, drink the sap of trees, but the most mature trees will not see any damage. Jeff?
Moving on to the obituaries. These were published in yesterday's Sunday, May 5th, Quad City Times. Phyllis T. Cohen died Wednesday, April 24th at Marsh's Edge, St. Simons Island, Georgia. Interment will take place on Monday, July 8th, at the Rock Island National Cemetery, The family asks those attending should arrive at Wirt's funeral home no later than 9:15 a.m. Online condolences may be expressed at wirtsfh.com. Phyllis was born July 17, 1930, in Chicago to Julius and Ruth Thomas. She earned her degree in home economics from Illinois Institute of Technology in 1952. It was at the IIT that she met George Cowan. They married on April 15, 1953, in Evanston, Illinois. Phyllis joined George as he served in the U.S. Army after the Korean War. They lived at Camp Fuchinobi for 18 months, and Phyllis immersed herself in Japanese culture and customs, which she later passed on to her daughters and grandchildren. Phyllis was a devoted mother to Janet and Carol. She raised her family in Parsippany, New Jersey through 1973, and then in Bettendorf. She put her family first and was always available for conversation and would listen before giving her wise advice. Phyllis was blessed to live in the same town as two of her grandchildren from their birth until they left for college. Often, along with George, they would have adventure, taking the grandchildren to local cultural and nature locales. Phyllis was preceded in death by George, her husband of 63 years. In 2019, she joined her daughter Carol and son-in-law in St. Simons Island, Georgia, moving to Marsh's Edge. Left to honor Phyllis' memory include daughters Janet and husband David Tidwell of Sugar Hill, Georgia, and Carol, husband William Brockway of St. Simons Island. Grandchildren Kristen Epping of Milwaukee, Hillary Epping of Davenport, and Michael Tidwell of Georgia, and one great-grandchild.
Timothy John Bowman, age 67, of Canyon County, California, passed away on March 26, 2024, after a brave battle with prostate cancer. Tim was cared for by his amazing friends, Carl and Star, along with Mr. Ed. Tim was born to John Dell and Laura Jean Ott Bauman on July 30, 1956, in Long Grove, Iowa. He graduated from North Scott High School in 1974. He soon moved to California. Other than Carl, Star, and Ed, Tim leaves behind the sisters he had to lovingly tolerate his whole life, Denise, Michelle, and Tracy. Denise and Don Westman in Minnesota, Michelle and Chuck Allman from Florida, and Tracy and Jim Welch on the family farm in Iowa. His sister-in-law, Valerie Bowman, was a big part of his life. Aunt Leanne Graves was always there for him. He always loved his nieces and nephews, along with all their children. Tim was preceded in death by his parents, brother Matthew Bowman, sister Kristen Schwartz, his maternal grandparents, Alvin and Velma Ott, and his beloved grandma and grandpa, B. Lester and Blanche Bowman. We will celebrate his life this summer.
Bruce Michael Summers, age 65, of Cottleville, Missouri, formerly of Bettendorf, passed away on April 28th at Evelyn's House Hospice Facility in Crèvecœur, Missouri, after a courageous two-year battle with cholangiocarcinoma. Bruce was born July 30th, 1958, in Panna, Illinois. He was a dedicated family man, survived by his wife, Christine, son, Scott, and his girlfriend, Joanne Tang, brother Jeff, his wife Debbie Summers, sisters-in-law Connie Summers and Michelle and husband Lon Roush, nephews Stanton and spouse Bonnie Summers and Harrison, girlfriend Brittany Johnson Summers, nieces Lauren, spouse Aaron Rosapaya and Lindsay Roush. He was preceded in death by his father, Stan Summers, mother, Bea Summers, brother, Steve Summers, mother-in-law, Nan Leslie, and father-in-law, Denny Leslie. In his career, Bruce worked for Navy Brand Manufacturing for 25 years as a sales representative, served as a volunteer lieutenant on the Bettendorf Fire Department for 12 years, and most recently worked for Farm and Home Supply in Cottleville, Missouri. Consistent with Bruce's wishes, a service will not be held, and the date for a future celebration of life will be determined. In lieu of flowers, donations will be made to Siteman Cancer Center or Evelyn's House General Support Fund in honor of Bruce.
Marilyn Lemon passed away peacefully at age 94 in Rockford, Mississippi. She and her husband of 63 years, Jack Lemon, who predeceased her in 2014, were residents of Bettendorf and Riverdale from 1930 to 1968. She is also predeceased by her brother, Gerald Smith, and her sister, Roberta Ralphs. Marilyn was a teacher at Forest Grove and Belmont schools for 5 years prior to the birth of her children. She is survived by her children, Kathy Vidal and husband Bob, Sharon Phillips and husband Carrie Michael, Richard Lemon and wife Deb, 6 grandchildren, 7 grandchildren, and her sister, Mary June Brown, and husband Don.
Shirley Johnson, age 90, of Sioux Falls, South Dakota, died January 9th at her apartment at Legends at Lake Lorraine. Shirley was the daughter of Cecil and Vera Oderkook. She graduated from Davenport High School and attended the University of Iowa, where she met Bill Johnson. She and Bill were married for nearly 50 years until his death. Shirley was a proud 50-year member of the philanthropic organization PEO and a lifelong member of St. John's United Methodist Church. She was a voracious reader, always enjoyed a road trip, loved cats, and made sure her bird feeders were filled to attract goldfinches and other birds. Grateful for having shared her life are her daughter and son-in-law, Suzanne and Larry Toll of Sioux Falls, and a daughter, Jay Johnson of Los Angeles, California. Shirley was preceded in death by her husband, Bill, and her parents. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. on Tuesday, May 14th, at the chapel at Davenport Memorial Park.
Eric B. Zalman, 52, formerly of Bettendorf, Iowa, passed away suddenly in his home in Las Vegas, Nevada, on Tuesday, March 19th, 2024. Visitation will be held from 4 to 6 p.m. on Saturday, May 11th, 2024, at the Runge Mortuary and Crematory. Online condolences may be expressed at www.rungemortuary.com. Those left to cherish his memory include his mother, Jean Paula Vlack, and his father, Robert B. Zalman. He was preceded in death by his brother, Robert W. Zalman, and stepfather, Michael S. Vlack.
Funeral services for Dwayne R. Miller, age 81, of Eldridge, will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Friday, May 10th, at Faith Lutheran Church in Eldridge. Burial with military honors will be at Mount Joy Cemetery in Parkview. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. on Thursday at Faith Lutheran Church. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to Faith Lutheran Church, Edward W. Napper, VFW Post 6174, Medic Ambulance, or the Clarissa Cook Hospice House. Chambers Funeral Home of Eldridge is assisting the family with arrangements. To view Dwayne's entire obituary, please visit McGinnisChambers.com.
Frederick Powell Beecher, 95, of Davenport, Iowa, passed away peacefully at his home on Monday, April 29th, 2024. A memorial mass will be celebrated at 11 a.m. Thursday, May 9th, 2024, at St. Andrew's Catholic Church in Bluegrass, Visitation will be held from 10 until 11 a.m. Thursday morning at the church. Halligan McCabe DeVry Funeral Home is assisting the family. Memorials may be made to St. Andrew's or St. Jude's Christian Hospital. Frederick Paul Beecher was born February 23, 1929, in Decatur, Illinois, to Vivian Powell and Leon Beecher. He was united in marriage to May Sue, known as Sue Curran, on May 6, 1950, in Dixon, Illinois. She preceded him in death on March 16, 2017. He later married Joanne, known as Joe Arthur Doof, on October 15, 2017, at St. Anthony's Catholic Church in Davenport, Iowa. Frederick is survived by his wife, Joe, of Davenport, his son, Mike, and spouse Michelle Beecher of Palatine, Illinois, his children Michael, spouse Debbie Beecher, and Matthew Beecher, his daughter Susan and spouse Jerry Hahn of Davenport, Iowa, and their children Jerry and spouse Melanie Hahn and Katie and spouse Creighton Duncan, and Jessica, spouse Jason Kluver. His son David and spouse Becky of Beecher, spouse Becky Beecher of Iowa City, Iowa, and their children, Nick and spouse Taylor Beecher, Alex and spouse Andrea Beecher, Asia and spouse Jared Reed, Andy Beecher, Tony and spouse Abby Sturgill, Tim and spouse Katie Sturgill, and his son Matthew and spouse Leisha Beecher of Davenport, and their children Emily Beecher and spouse Zach Schmidt, Ella and Ben Beecher. Fred was also Grandpa the Great to 27 great-grandchildren. Fred was preceded in death by his wife Sue, his parents, and a brother Bert Beecher. Online condolences may be expressed by visiting Fred's obituary at hmdfuneralhome.com.
Chad W. Peters, age 46, of Clinton, passed away Sunday, April 21st at Genesis East Hospital in Davenport. In following Chad's wishes, cremation rites have been accorded. A celebration of life will take place at the Imperial Lanes in Comanche on Saturday, May 18th, starting at 3 p.m. The Pape Funeral Home is assisting the family. Chad was born in Clinton on December 9, 1977, son of Galen and Diane Johnson Peters. He graduated from East Central High School in 1996 and attended Clinton Community College. Chad was senior designer at IMEG in Rock Island. He was baptized and confirmed at Faith Lutheran Church in Andover. Chad enjoyed spending time with his niece Kelly, whom he truly adored, hunting, fishing trips with his buddies, playing washers, and bowling. He was the youngest junior bowler in Clinton to roll a 300 game. He totaled 19 300 games and an 800 series in his career. Chad was a member of the Clinton USBC Hall of Fame. He loved being outdoors and was a fan of the St. Louis Cardinals and New Orleans Saints. Chad survived by his parents, Galen and Diane Peters of Teeds Grove, a brother, Eric Peters, and spouse, Sherry Fraley of Comanche, his niece, Kaylee, his grandfather, Robert, and spouse, Martha Peters of Melbourne, Arkansas, and aunts, uncles, and cousins. He was preceded in death by his grandparents, Carol Jacobson, Gelda Peters, and Ralph Johnson. Online condolences may be left at papefh.com.
And our final obituary is for Joan, known as Leslie Weeks, who died Joan Leslie Weeks of Bettendorf, Iowa, died on May 2nd, 2024. A visitation will be held Tuesday, May 7th, 2024, at the Runge Mortuary. Funeral services will be held Wednesday, May 8th, in the Mortuary Chapel. She will be laid to rest with her husband, Richard, in the Rock Island National Cemetery. Memorials may be made to the Scott County Humane Society. Online condolences may be expressed at www.rungemortuary.com. Joan was born September 19, 1937, in Coldwater, Michigan, to John and Alva Kirtland Lessie. She married Richard Weeks on June 2, 1956, and they remained married until his passing in 2019. Joan was primarily a homemaker, but obtained her CAN certificate later in life. Survivors include her children, Randy, with spouse Monica Weeks of Pleasant Valley, Iowa, Jason and Melissa Weeks of Bettendorf, Colleen Hensey of Davenport, Iowa, Melody and Richard McHugh of Moline, Illinois, Joy Reagan of Advance, Indiana, Pamela Lyle of Fort Collins, Colorado, a brother, Ira, and Deb Leslie of Ashley, Indiana, sister Sally and Ken Freed of Rome City, Indiana, 15 grandchildren and 18 great-grandchildren. She was preceded in death by her parents, her husband, sisters Sue Smith and Jane Leslie, granddaughters Amy, Monique, and Joanne Weeks, and son-in-law David Hensey.
These are the pending services listed in yesterday's paper. Stephen G. Eshleman, 40, of East Peoria, died Thursday, May 2nd at Unity Point Health in Trinity, Rock Island. Cremation will be directed by the Cremation Society of the Quad Cities. Vicki Bickford, age 66, of Monmouth, passed away Thursday, May 2nd at home. Arrangements are pending at Carson Celebration of Life Center in Maquoketa. Carol Brophy, age 85, Bettendorf, formerly of Ames, died Saturday, May 4th in her home in the Fountains in Bettendorf. Cremation will be directed by the Cremation Society of the Quad Cities. Emma McCorkle, age 82, of Moline, died Friday, May 3rd at home. Cremation will be directed by the Cremation Society of the Quad Cities. Barry Moskowitz, 85, of Moline, died Friday, May 3rd in his home. Funeral arrangements are pending at Trimble Funeral Home and Crematory in Moline. Donald A. Ducky Stevens, age 80, of rural Altona, Illinois, died Friday, May 3rd in rural Cambridge, surrounded by his family. Arrangements at Stackhouse Moor Funeral and Cremation Services in Galva. And finally, Harlan W. Teasman, age 86, of Fulton, Illinois, passed away May 3rd at home, surrounded by his family. The Bosma Rinkes Funeral Home in Fulton is assisting with arrangements. Carol?
Thank you, Jeff. And that concludes obituaries for today. And we'll move over to the opinion page. As usual, there are two opinions entitled Courage or Change. And the first opinion is by Zainab Chaudhry. It's entitled Credit Protesters for Seeking a Better World. University campuses have long been the focus of political protests and demonstrations. In recent weeks, students galvanized by their consciences have been leading anti-war movements the likes of which has not been seen in the U.S. in decades and is spreading like wildfire. At last count, at least 100 encampments have been launched at colleges and universities. These students are setting up tents, staging sit-ins, and raising their voices in solidarity with the people of Gaza. But their courageous actions are about more than protesting the war. They're about demanding justice, challenging authority, and reshaping and normalizing the conversation around one of the most pressing issues of our time, freedom and liberation for Palestine. The urgency of this moment is spurred by the reality that for more than 200 days, they and the rest of the world have witnessed the Israeli government's brutal massacre of at least 34,000 Palestinian civilians in Gaza, including more than 14,000 children, according to the territory's health ministry. On April 30th, Haaretz reported that Israeli Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich, who is a member of the Security Cabinet, called for the total annihilation of Rafah and other areas of Gaza. This genocide is being waged with American students' tax dollars. A growing number of them recognize they have a moral obligation to mobilize swiftly against the Israeli government's violent, catastrophic rampage bolstered by the Biden administration and Congress. Many universities, such as Yale, aren't obligated to disclose most of their investable assets and SEC filings, and their investment portfolios are often not publicly accessible. This lack of transparency means there is no way of knowing how much might be invested into war manufacturing companies. That's why two of the critical demands of many student protesters launching encampments, such as at Johns Hopkins University, is that their universities disclose financials and divest from such companies. Student activists are risking their safety, freedom, education, and future for their cause. They deserve our gratitude, attention, and support. Instead, more than 1,000 people have been arrested in college protests, including when New York officers stormed Columbia University. In 1970, during the Vietnam War, the world was shaken by the events at Kent State University. Students protesting the war were met with violence, and four students were tragically killed by the National Guard. Just as the students at Kent State were protesting the violence of war, today's students are protesting Israel's decades-long violence and oppression of the Gazan people. The students are demanding an end to Israel's illegal occupation of Palestine, lifting the siege on Gaza, and an end to violations of Palestinian human rights. Like the students at Kent State, they are too often facing criticism, pushback, and violence for daring to speak out. Despite their challenges, these students are determined to make their voices heard. They are protesting on their campuses while no universities remain in Gaza. They recognize that silence in the face of oppression and genocide is not an option. They believe in the power of collective action and the importance of standing up for what is right, and they're willing to do what many others lack the courage or conviction or willpower to do: risk sacrificing to fight for a better world. The significance of the current campus activism represents an unequivocal rejection of the policies of fear and division. It's a reminder of what is possible when people unite and organize. Perhaps more important, it's a testament to the power of young people, proving they can shape the course of history and create real change. They are a reminder that the future belongs to those who are willing to stand up and fight for what they believe in. These students are on the right side of history. They inspire hope. They deserve our advocacy and solidarity. Please support their efforts, amplify their voices, and join them. Jeff?
Campus vitriol shows society is failing kids. This by Lynn Schmidt, who writes for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. What's happening on college campuses is morally repugnant, politically stupid, and continues to perpetuate the narrative that elite universities have been hijacked by the far left. The scenes from the elite pillars of higher education lately do not actually seem to be about the Israel-Hamas war at all. Rather, the chaos we are witnessing is due in part to too many in leadership positions acting as mere spectators instead of behaving as models for their institutions. At this point, the public does not know how many outside agitators are in the mix of students or who might be funding these protests and feeding the propaganda on social media. What we do know is that as a society, we are failing our children. University administrators and their boards of trustees have a responsibility to keep their students safe. They should handle the menace that is anti-Semitism the same way they would any other threats or harassment toward members of the student body, faculty, or staff, up to and including expulsion and termination. That's an abbreviated opinion piece, which brings us to the end of the Quad Cities Times for today. I'm Jeff Cassett. My partner at the microphone has been the wonderful Carol Lockhart. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.